the seismic Supreme Court ruling on presidential immunity that could shape America for years to come.
There is a principle that nobody is above the law, and it has always been understood that the president himself has to abide by the law. This opinion, not only does it grant this immunity, but it grants the immunity in some really sweeping ways, I think go far beyond anything anybody could have assumed.
Plus, thousands of Palestinians displaced multiple times already are ordered to relocate once again.
The latest order is a sign that Hamas has managed to regroup, and we could soon see Israeli forces moving back into Khan Yunis and a resumption of heavy fighting.
And the European leader with the closest ties to Russia meets with Ukraine's president in a rare visit to Kyiv. Today is July 2nd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Lori London. Israeli forces bombarded several areas of southern Gaza Tuesday, and thousands of Palestinians fled their homes in what could be part of a final push of Israel's intensive military operations in 9 months of war. Associated Press correspondent Yosef Fetterman reports.
The Israeli military has ordered a mass evacuation from a large part of the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis. This isn't the first time we've seen an evacuation order like this. Israel spent several months inside Khan Yunis battling Hamas before withdrawing earlier this year. The latest order is a sign that Hamas has managed to regroup, and we could soon see Israeli forces moving back into Khan Yunis and a resumption of heavy fighting.
AP correspondent Yosef Fetterman. Gaza's European hospital in Khan Yunis is virtually empty, with staff and patients fleeing after the Israeli army's orders for residents in the surrounding areas to evacuate. UNRWA spokesperson Louise Waterridge.
UNRWA estimates that around 250,000 people have been impacted by these orders. Of course, as usual, we expect these numbers to grow. But, you know, for us, this is it's another devastating blow to the humanitarian response here. It's another devastating blow for the people and the families on the ground. It seems that they are forcibly being displaced again and again. You know, making these decisions is now impossible.
Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken affirmed Monday that President Joe Biden's proposal to end the Israel-Hamas conflict is achievable and urged Hamas to accept it. Blinken also underlined the importance of post-war plans to rebuild Gaza and prevent a security vacuum in the territory. VOA's Veronica Balteras Iglesias reports.
As Israeli troops continue deepening their incursions in Gaza in search of militants, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced Monday that Hamas's military capabilities have almost been eliminated.
We are advancing to the end of the phase of eliminating the terrorist army of Hamas, and there will be a continuation to strike its remnants.
The announcement was made as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, in an interview at the Brookings Institution in Washington, called on Hamas's leadership to accept a phased peace proposal currently on the table.
I think the proposal that President Biden put forward is achievable. And it would be the best way forward, the quickest way to end the conflict in Gaza, to stop the violence, to massively surge assistance, to get everyone home, including American hostages.
As the secretary spoke, the voices of protesters gathered outside the Brookings Institution could also be heard. Blinken, who didn't acknowledge them, stressed that the Israel-Hamas conflict cannot end with a vacuum in Gaza.
It has to end in a way that makes sure that there are clear, coherent, achievable plans for Gaza's governance, for its security, and of course, to start to help people to rebuild their lives that have been so decimated and destroyed.
One of the Palestinians whose life has radically changed and wants accountability is Dr. Mohammed Abu Selmeya. The director of Al-Shifa Hospital was released early Monday after being in Israeli custody since November. He says prisoners were subjected to severe torture and his little finger was broken. He was repeatedly hit on the head until he bled. He says there was almost daily torture in Israeli prisons.
We were subjected to severe torture. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. Yeheye Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It's really devastating that we have had to stop supporting life-saving medical care at this hospital, particularly in the face of such great and growing medical needs.
That's Claire Sanfilippo, Emergency Coordinator for Sudan's Doctors Without Borders, on the decision to suspend its activities at one of the few hospitals still operating in the capital. Details coming up. Also, a cage-like structure has been sent into one of South Africa's deepest gold mines to bring out trapped illegal miners. And Interpol says an operation targeting illegal mining in four West African countries has led to 200 arrests. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, says it has suspended its activities at one of the few hospitals still operating in Sudan's capital due to ongoing attacks on patients and staff. Claire Sanfilippo, MSF Emergency Coordinator for Sudan, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that for the past 20 months, armed fighters have repeatedly entered Bashir Teaching Hospital in Khartoum, demanding their injured fighters be treated before other patients. She says an incident last month was the last straw when the fighters began firing inside the emergency ward.
Bashir Hospital has provided life-saving activities. It's really devastating that we have had to stop supporting life-saving medical care at this hospital, particularly in the face of such great and growing medical needs. Every single time that an organization is forced to suspend activities, patients have less access to medical care they desperately need.
What made MSF close the hospital or not work there anymore?
Well, unfortunately, we have experienced repeated incidents, security incidents, particularly of armed fighters entering the hospital with weapons and threatening medical staff. Very often, what we've seen is that these armed men would demand fighters to be treated before other patients. And on the 11th of November, a patient was shot dead inside the hospital. And then the 18th of December, barely 5 weeks later, attackers fired weapons inside the emergency ward, directly threatening medical staff. Luckily, no one was injured, but everyone was extremely affected, of course, by this traumatic aggression inside the hospital. So attacks against medical facilities and health personnel are absolutely unacceptable.
It's a violation of international law. Isn't it?
Well, for us, it is absolutely unacceptable because hospitals must remain safe spaces where patients can come and seek access to healthcare. They're open to everyone. And this is why it's very unfortunate, but we had to take this decision to suspend medical care because it was simply untenable. And the safety of our patients and our staff is paramount.
Could MSF tell who the armed men were that intruded and actually killed that man and threatened the healthcare workers?
Well, I can tell you that these were armed men in this latest incident who came into the facility and directly threatened the staff. But since the beginning of this conflict, health facilities have been looted, occupied, and shelled. Healthcare workers have been and continue to be intimidated, harassed, and assaulted. Since the beginning of the conflict, Doctors Without Borders alone, and that's only until August last year, has experienced at least 84 incidents, ranging from clashes and looting of medical supplies in hospital and warehouses to incidents related to weapons being fired in the facilities that we support. And the result of this violence is that we've been forced to suspend activities in various locations in Wad Madani, in Al Jazeera State, in Al-Fashir, in North Darfur, and in Khartoum, both in the Turkish hospitals and now lately in Al-Bashir hospitals. So this violence that is really repeated and that is a feature and in this war critically hinder patients' access to care, but also our ability to deliver care at a time where it is needed more than ever because of the massive humanitarian and medical needs in the country.
That was Claire Sanfilippo, MSF Emergency Coordinator for Sudan, speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam, underscoring the risks volunteer rescuers say shelling in western Omdurman, the capital's twin city just across the Nile River, killed at least 120 people Monday as fighting between the army and the paramilitaries escalates nationwide. Somalia and Ethiopia announced Saturday they would restore full diplomatic relations following a visit by Somalia's president to Addis Ababa to heal a year-long rift that threatened further instability in the Horn of Africa. The controversy was diffused by a peace deal mediated by Turkey and signed last month by leaders from both countries, reiterating their commitment to the deal and its spirit of friendship and solidarity. David Monda, professor of political science at City University of New York, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi the significance of the development on stability in the Horn of Africa.
I think it's very significant on two fronts because Ethiopia and Somalia are key players in the African Union and in the Horn of Africa. So a regional war in the Horn of Africa between the two states is very destabilizing. But it's also a good sign in terms of Turkey's mediation as a neutral arbiter on the continent. It also shows Turkey's growing influence in Africa in terms of bringing these two regional rivals together to actually come up with an agreement because Turkey has major interests in both Ethiopia and Somalia. I think also lastly, it shows that Addis Ababa and Mogadishu have realized that a conflict between them would actually be mutually destructive. Ethiopia has its own internal problems. We know in the Tigray region, in the Ogaden region, in the Addis metropole area. And Somalia, as we know, has challenges with Somaliland and with issues of Al-Shabaab. They have domestic problems. So I think this move is logical. It's rational for both countries. And I think it's more broadly helpful in terms of regional stability.
Egyptian troops joined the African Union support and stabilization mission in Somalia to fight Somali Islamist insurgents that launched this month. Ethiopia, which has been a key ally of Somalia in its fight against the Al-Qaeda-linked militants and is at loggerheads with Egypt over the Renaissance Dam, said it could not stand idle while other actors take measures to destabilize the region. Why was Ethiopia so alarmed by an Egyptian-Somali alliance?
I think at two levels. For one, Ethiopia wants to be the regional power and sees Egypt coming into the regional politics of the Horn of Africa as a challenge to Ethiopia's hegemony in the region. I think at a security perspective, Ethiopia is very concerned that Egypt will rearm the Somali army, and that will be a major strategic threat to Ethiopia because we know historically Somalia has had an irredentist claim over the Ogaden region of Ethiopia. So Addis is very concerned that an Egypt-Somali alliance will not only challenge its regional hegemony, but will be a strategic threat to the Ogaden region and some of the separatist forces in that area that want to be part of Somalia. I think thirdly, it's more of an ideational perspective in terms of how Ethiopia perceives this alliance between Somalia and Egypt. Both Egypt and Somalia are Arab countries. They are members of the Arab League. So this really increases a profile of Somalia diplomatically within the Arab nations and the Arab League. I think something that Addis Ababa is very concerned about.
Egypt's Foreign Minister Badr Abdel-Aati said the Red Sea and its security is subject only to the will of the countries on its coast. And it's absolutely unacceptable for any country not bordering the Red Sea to have a presence, whether military, naval, or otherwise. Can you explain why Egypt is taking that position?
Egypt's taking that position to sideline and marginalize Ethiopia. As we know, Ethiopia does not have access to the Red Sea. Once Eritrea Eritrea became independent. So by doing this, what Egypt is actually trying to do is to say that Somalia has every right to get into alliances with whichever country it feels like, particularly because both Egypt and Somalia have access to the Red Sea. Both Egypt and Somalia are key players within the context of geostrategic choke points. By that, I mean Egypt is central to the Suez Canal and to access so maritime traffic in that area of the Red Sea, whereas Somalia has the largest coastline in Africa, and a large part of that is on the Red Sea. So thereby, Egypt is really trying to sideline Ethiopia and reinforce its strategic partnership with Somalia. I must add that we cannot look at this statement outside of the regional rivalry between Ethiopia and Egypt, specifically around the Grand Ethiopia Renaissance Dam and the challenges that Egypt has had with that in terms of its water right.
That was David Monder, professor of political science at City University of New York, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. One of the world's biggest steelmakers, ArcelorMittal, says it will stop operating in South Africa at the end of January. Industry experts expect Africa's largest economy to lose 100,000 jobs as a result, adding to an unemployment rate of 32%, one of the highest in the world. Darren Taylor reports.
ArcelorMittal insiders tell VOA it's no longer profitable for it to make steel in South Africa, in part because of falling local demand given slow economic growth and because of unreliable electricity. During a recent online media briefing, ArcelorMittal South Africa's CEO Kobus Verster said the government also hasn't done enough to protect local manufacturers from cheap steel imports from China.
China's exports last year was at record levels, so it obviously impacts global steel prices because China exports a lot of excess steel not only to Africa and South Africa, but also to Brazil and Europe and all those markets. So obviously it impacts on the price, but from a volume perspective in South Africa, yes, it does play a role. Around 50% of the imports into the country is from China.
Economists explain China can sell steel well below market prices because the state subsidizes its producers and its labor costs are extremely low. In recent years, China's real estate and construction sectors have slowed, leaving it with vast tons of unsold steel. The leader of South Africa's National Metalworkers Union, Irvin Jim, tells VOA China has dumped excess steel on global markets, wiping out local manufacturers and triggering job losses. But while other regions have curbed this by imposing tariffs on Chinese steel, most African countries haven't. Jim says African governments don't want to offend the continent's largest trade partner. He says ArcelorMittal's closure will hurt almost all manufacturing in South Africa.
This will not just affect the steel industry. The auto sector will be negatively affected. The component value chain will be negatively affected because it is those works of ArcelorMittal that are delivering specialized steel that can be used in cars in terms of component value chain.
Yamkela Fanisi, spokesperson for South Africa's Department of Trade and Industry, told VOA that Pretoria is committed to protecting the country's steel industry.
This industry is the backbone of industrialization, reindustrialization, that will help us recover our economy.
Verster said the government's always been willing to listen to complaints from local steel manufacturers, but has not been able to make decisions. Justin Corbett is chief executive officer of Rand York, a company that depends on specialized steel from ArcelorMittal to forge castings for South Africa's automobile, mining and building sectors.
As much as 32% or approximately 450,000 tons of steel is unique to ArcelorMittal and is not being made by the other mills in the country. Right now, Rand York and other companies in South Africa are going to be faced with broken supply chains and a very, very difficult situation in terms of continuity.
He says the loss of ArcelorMittal's specialized products means his company and others will need to find overseas sources. Corbett also says South Africa hosts subsidiaries of several of the world's leading original equipment manufacturers, or OEMs, that also used ArcelorMittal's specialized steel.
The OEMs are under extraordinary pressure to keep local production. Major OEMs like Volkswagen and Toyota and the rest of them, every time a new model comes in, it's a marginal situation whether they continue manufacturing in South Africa or they look elsewhere. And if we lose this critical steel capability, I'm so fearful that we lose big labor-oriented manufacturing when they relocate the manufacturing to other territories.
Going forward, say industry experts, African governments should impose tariffs on Chinese-made steel or risk having local industries crumble. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. Rescuers have sent a cage-like structure into one of South Africa's deepest gold mines to bring out illegal miners trapped for months in an abandoned shaft. The Associated Press reports more than 100 are believed to have died of starvation or dehydration. Civic organizations and groups representing the miners say at least 24 bodies and 34 survivors have been brought out of the Bafelfontein gold mine since Friday, but more than 500 miners are still believed to be underground. They say many are ill and starving. The International Policy Agency, Interpol, says an operation targeting illegal mining in Burkina Faso, the Gambia, Guinea, and Senegal has led to 200 arrests. Operation Sanu, which ran July through October last year, brought together experts from Interpol and national law enforcement agencies. The effort included hundreds of officers deployed to identify criminal routes and modus operandi in a remote area of the four countries. As U.S. President-elect Donald Trump prepares for his second inauguration on January 20th, thousands of miles away in Nigeria, his return to power has reignited hope among Biafra secessionists. Some view him as a possible ally in their decades-long battle for autonomy, though at least one analyst thinks they should lower their expectations. Timothy Obiesu reports from Abuja.
On the morning of November 6th, Odinaka Nwankwo, a retired footballer, sat on his porch in Anambra State, southeastern Nigeria, listening to the results of the U.S. presidential election on his transistor radio. After a few hours, the news broke that Republican candidate Donald Trump had defeated opponent Kamala Harris. Nwankwo, a supporter of the Biafra secessionist movement, says jubilation immediately erupted.
We know that Trump can go straight to them and tell them, resolve this issue of Biafra. If they want to be free, let them be free. I think that is only why the South is excited about his coming. Not that he will give the South East Biafra, but at least he used to be blunt about issues, because he doesn't know how to play politics up.
Donald Trump won both the Electoral College and popular vote to become the 47th U.S. president-elect. Biafra separatist communities are now expressing hope that Trump's presidency, which begins on January the 20th, could be a turning point for their movement. Ifeanyi Okorafo is a resident of Imo State in southeast Nigeria.
Marginalization is subjection, and it will not end. It will never end until secession comes. But the world is talking about Trump coming in because America is a force in the world power. They know they can dictate certain things that may happen elsewhere. So it may not be that easy, though. Trump, because he's a Republican and their manner of doing things is what the people are seeing.
The Biafra movement has been seeking independence from Nigeria for decades. A secession attempt in 1967 led to a brutal civil war that lasted 3 years and killed over 1 million people, mostly from starvation. Critics say that when it comes to Trump, Biafran activists may be too optimistic. Ahmed Buhari is a Nigerian political analyst.
Trump has clearly defined himself as that president who puts America first. So for him to support any sort of mission, it will have to be clear on what is going to benefit the American people. Until that is properly defined, he might not be interested in having that conversation with the Biafra people.
But Biafran supporter and human rights lawyer Prince Mandela is hoping Trump will put pressure on Nigeria's authorities to address Biafra's concerns, including the release of activist leader Nnamdi Kanu, who's been held by authorities against court orders granting him bail.
Donald Trump is someone that's, you know, kicked against the breach of violation of fundamental rights. So a man like Donald Trump coming to power, my one way or the other, is coming to power will now help eliminate some of their persecutions.
During his first term, Trump queried then Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari about violence against Christians in Nigeria, an issue Biafrans often frame as vital to their struggle. Beyond that, Trump seemed to pay little attention to Nigeria or Africa as a whole. Biafran secessionists are hoping that this time around, the issue can make it onto Trump's agenda. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
A Ugandan military court has ruled that a prominent opposition figure, Kizza Besigye, will stand trial on a treachery charge, which can carry the death penalty. The Associated Press says the move increases the legal trouble Kizza Besigye faces ahead of presidential elections scheduled for 2026. Besigye, who has contested the presidency four times, went missing in the Kenyan capital Nairobi on November 16th. Days later, he appeared before a military court on charges of illegal possession of firearm and an alleged threat to national security. A military prosecutor on Monday amended the charges and included treachery.
VOA Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Pete Huntley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.